Good morning. How's everybody doing? Good. I realize that for those at home, they're not able to hear this front mic up here. I don't know what's going on. So if you're at home right now and you didn't hear some that was going on, then that's the reason. So we're going to work on that. But for the rest of y'all, you all were able to listen to those words about Jesus and the sacrifice that was made on our behalf. And what a wonderful, glorious thing it is to be able to come here in his name and to honor him in this way. So we've been looking at the Sermon on the Mount. That's been our topic for the last part of this of this year. And really, it's just going to bring us all the way to the end of this year. And into next year, we're going to continue looking at some topics that come from Matthew, but we're going to look at it a little bit differently in a little different context for next year's sermon series and next year's theme. And so, but for now, we're looking at the Sermon on the Mount. And this month, we began by looking at the Beatitudes, and we talked about what those mean and what it means to be the blessed ones of the kingdom of heaven, and how when Jesus comes, or when he did come, that he called in people that were very unlikely. Remember, these were the people that were being brought to him, these sick, these hurting, these broken people of God, these very unlikely people of Jesus, and he brings them in, and he says that good news of the kingdom of heaven too. And so these unlikely people, Jesus is calling them to join him in changing the world, to be world changers, to influence the world around them. Kind of a catalyst for good will come from these blessed people, these peoples of God that belong to the kingdom of heaven. And so Jesus uses two metaphors as we continue on through the Sermon on the Mount. And these two metaphors, I believe, are connected to the section that we just read about the Beatitudes. But these two metaphors talk about disciples of Jesus, followers of Jesus, and how they influence the world. And so let's look at these metaphors. In Matthew chapter 5, starting at verse 13, Jesus simply says, You are the salt of the earth. You are the salt of the earth. Not you will be the salt of the earth, but you are, as a disciple of Jesus, as one of the blessed of the kingdom of heaven, you are salt. You are the salt of the earth. But he says, if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? And it is no longer good for anything except to throw out and to trample underfoot by men. So really simple. What is salt used for? I mean, what do we do with salt? We put it on what? On food, right? We put our salt on food. We might put salt on baked potatoes. I love putting salt on my popcorn. That's my thing. I love salted popcorn. And popcorn without salt is just, it's just not there, right? I mean, it's just puffed air. It's not really that good. But salt makes all the difference, doesn't it? It influences that food and makes it good. Salt does other things, though, doesn't it? It's a preservative. It helps in preserving different types of food. And so we understand that salt has a purpose. Salt is, it's a very simple metaphor. But in the Old Testament, salt had other meanings too. Salt was used as an incense before the Ark of the Covenant to burn incense. There were salt added to that, the formula that God had given to them to make an incense for that purpose. There's salt that was used in offering. There are salt that is put in the sacrifices, in the offerings, as a sign or a symbol of the covenant that God made with Israel. And we can find that in the book of Leviticus. You just go ahead and read it. I'll let you read it. Read the whole book, and then you tell me where it's at. That's your homework assignment. And so Leviticus, we talks about salt as being a type of the covenant. But we don't really need to go too far away from the simplicity of this metaphor. I don't think it's meant to be super complicated. I think it's really simple what Jesus is saying, that salt is influential. Salt is influential. In food, it changes the flavor, right? You know, food that doesn't have salt in it is not always that appetizing. That's really the simple idea here. And if something loses its saltiness, how do you make it salty again? I mean, how do you take something that was once influential and is now not and make it influential again? How do you do that? How do you bring back the saltiness of something? We recognize that Jesus is saying that sometimes salt loses its influence. And what good is it? I mean, what do you do with salt that's not salty anymore? What is it good for? Just throw it on the road, right? I mean, just step on it. It's not good for anything. It doesn't have any value because it's all of its value, all of its worth comes from its saltiness, its influence. And Jesus makes that point very clear in the metaphor that kingdom people, right? Followers of Jesus are to be influential. They are to live influential lives in the world in which they are placed. They are the salt of the earth. Not just because we exist, right? Don't get confused about that. Not just because we exist. It's not a big ego thing. That's not the point. But because we are citizens of the kingdom of heaven, disciples of Jesus, followers of Jesus, we are salt and we are influential. And so the next one is also very easy, right? I love these really easy metaphors. The next one is really easy. Matthew chapter 5, verses 14 and following. Jesus says, you are, then again, not you will be, but you are the light of the world. And then he makes some very easy things, easy analogies here. He says the city on a hill, right? I mean, we can kind of picture that concept, the city on a hill, off in the distance. You can't hide it. That's his point. The city on the hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Then again, very simple. We don't want to miss the simplicity of Jesus' words here. And what does light do? That's simple, right? What does light do? It expels what? Darkness. It exposes things, right? It lights up the room. These are characteristics of light that we know about. We know what light does, what its purpose is, to provide light, to be seen, right? And the city on the hill, then again, it's hard to miss a city on a hill. You're not going to hide it. If it's lit and it's up there, you're going to see it, and it's very difficult not to see. And Jesus is comparing his disciples and saying that you are the light of the world. And what about a lamp? You know, you light a lamp and you've got it in a room and then you put a basket over it. I mean, what good is that, right? I mean, what's the purpose of that? Why would anybody do something like that? You know, somebody might think, well, you know, this is my light. I'm going to keep it to myself. And you put a basket over it and said, I'm just keeping it over here to myself, right? And you can't use it. They can't use it. You're not going to be able to see it because I'm hiding it. Well, it doesn't make any sense. And that's the simplicity of it, right? It doesn't make sense. It's not logical. It's more logical to take the light and the lamp and to put it on a lampstand so that everybody can enjoy it, right? So that everybody benefits from the light. We share it. We are the light of the world. In verse 16, he says, let your light shine before men in such a way that you may see, they may see your good works and glorify you. Is that what it says? To praise you. Is that the purpose of letting our light shine? No, he says to glorify your Father who is in heaven. Right? So they see you and God is glorified. God is exalted because of you and your light and your influence in the world. So as disciples of Jesus, right? This is really simple. You're salt as disciples of Jesus. So be salt. Be influential. Be salty. Right? And so you're light as disciples of Jesus. So what do you expect from that? Be light. I was going to kind of play off the salty, and I was going to say be lit, but I think that has a totally different meaning today than it used to be, you know, that concept. But be light, right? Be an illumination in the world. Be light and let your light shine. See, these are really simple, aren't they? But as simple as they are, they also have a rooted historical application. And I think we need to make sure that we pick up on the simplicity of it, but we also dig a little deeper and we draw from it what the Jews would have gathered from Jesus' words, from their history about things like this. So what I want to do this morning is I want us to go to Isaiah 42, and I want us to explore a little bit about how the Jews would have picked up on this from a prophetic aspect in the expectation of the kingdom of heaven. In other words, when the Messiah comes, what things are we to expect of those who follow the Messiah, the new nation of Israel that's coming forth through him? So in 42, this is one of the many servant songs in Isaiah. They begin in 42, they end in 53. You're probably very familiar with the suffering servant of Isaiah 53, right? That's a very popular servant song. But this is the beginning of it. And he says, "Behold," God says, my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him, and he will bring forth justice to the nations. Now, just from that first little reading, being Jesus people, right? Being disciples of Jesus and knowing the New Testament, who would we say Isaiah is talking about? Who's God talking about in this passage? Who's the focal point? Who's the servant? From just this passage alone and what we understand about the New Testament, who is the servant here? What's your immediate thought? It's Jesus, right? Yeah, that's who this is. This obviously points to Jesus. But I want us to realize that there's a bigger context here, right? I mean, sometimes we pull passages out of context, and obviously this is quoted in Matthew chapter 12, an application to Jesus, don't get me wrong, but there is a bigger context in Isaiah that needs to be picked up on as well. So I always encourage everybody to do what? Read the entire book, you know, go through and read it. Figure out what Isaiah is talking about here, what God is talking about. So we'll go back just to the first chapter, all right? The next chapter, rather, 41, and look at verse 8. And this is kind of where this context begins. And God says, "But you, Israel, my what? My servant, okay? Jacob, whom I have chosen, descendant of Abraham, my friend." And so there's two ways, right? The Jews would think about this without the knowledge of Jesus. They would think this is Israel, but they realize that there's more to it, right? They realize that there's something more to it, but nonetheless, it's Israel. That Israel, they are God's chosen people, that they are the servant in whom God wants to delight in, that God will put his spirit upon them, that they will be the ones to bring justice to the nations. Now look at the next verse of 42, okay, chapter 42. "He will not cry out or raise his voice." Now, in your version, you probably have a capital H on there. It's because the translators are already picking up on the fact that this is messianic in nature. And he says, "He will cry out and raise his voice, nor will he make a voice heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands will wait expectantly for his law, for his instruction." So God is committed to his servant, right? God is committed to his servant, and the servant is committed to God and doing God's will. And the earth, what is it doing? The coastlands. They're doing something. They're waiting. But are they waiting with kind of discouragement? Are they waiting for the law to come and thinking, "Man, I just don't, I'm not looking forward to this. This is not what I want. I don't want this." But what are they doing? They're waiting expectantly, right? This idea that they're hopeful. They're hopeful of the instruction that's going to come through the servant. The world, those outside of God's covenant family, are hopeful. There is a hopeful expectation that through the servant, God's going to bring about his rule and his reign and his law. And people are expecting this. And this is what we see unfolding in the Sermon on the Mount, isn't it? Isn't this what we're looking at when Jesus unfolds the Sermon on the Mount, that we are seeing Jesus introducing to us a new and better way of living? This is a new way of living. This is a new way of thinking. This is a new way of being God's people. Even to the Jews, this was something that they needed to understand. And some people, they're going to come into this, they're going to hear Jesus' words, and they're going to embrace it. And that's as if that's what they've been waiting for all along. They're going to say, yes, I've been waiting for this day. I'm so grateful that the servant has finally shown up and he's here and he's doing what Israel had failed to do. And now I'm going to embrace this and I'm going to become part of this movement right here in the middle of Jerusalem. And it's going to be good. Because I know that God has a purpose for this. And there are going to be some who are just going to flat out reject it, right? They're going to see and hear, and they're going to say, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with that. It's not what I want. It doesn't line up with what I desire. It doesn't line up with my thoughts. It doesn't line up with my expectations. How often do we do that, right? How often do we hear something and we think, well, that doesn't line up with what I want. It's not what I want. It's not what I desire. It's not what I think. And what do we do with it? Oh, we instantly change our mind, don't we? I mean, we just embrace it and say, well, I'm just going to have to change. Is that how we work? No. People don't do that. They hear things like that and they often reject it, right? But those who hear Jesus are faced with that same kind of distress, if you will. They're faced with that same kind of tension. That's the storyline. It's full of tension. Will they embrace it or will they reject it? Now look at the next verse. The next verse says, thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out and who spread out the earth and its offspring and who gives breath to the people on earth and spirit to those who walk in it. This is God talking, right? I mean, this is Creator God, the creator of all things, the one who has given the breath of life to all that lives. He is the one who is saying this about his servant. Verse 6, he says, I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness, and I will also hold you by the hand and watch over you. And I appointed you. This was the appointing, right? This is what God has given to his servant. I have appointed you as a covenant to the people. All right? To be a covenant to the people. In other words, the means through whom people, Gentiles, will come into a covenant relationship with the Lord. He will be a covenant to the people. Remember salt, that simple metaphor of Jesus. It also has another meaning in the Old Testament of a symbol of God's covenant relationship with Israel. So here we have Isaiah, God speaking through Isaiah, saying that his servant is going to be appointed to be a covenant to the people. And then he says, as a light to the nations, to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the dungeon, and those who dwell in darkness from the prison. Now, the religious leaders of Jesus' day, they were extremely evangelistic. We don't think about them as being evangelistic, but we always think about them as kind of being to reject everything that everybody did and the haters of the Samaritans and the haters of the Gentiles. But they were extremely evangelistic, and to a point where I feel like they probably were trying to fulfill some of these expectations, right? If we can just bring the Gentiles in and make them like us, then the Messianic kingdom will break in and we'll be able to reign and rule over them, that kind of an idea. But instead of being a covenant to the people, instead of being a light to the nations that opens up the eyes to the blind, they converted people to their own form of religion. They converted people to their own ideas and concepts of righteousness, to a type of righteousness that Jesus will condemn in Matthew. And the people they converted, they're not seeing, they're blind. Right? They're just as blind as the Pharisees. They cannot see what God is doing in the world. They cannot see what God is attempting to do through them. And Jesus even says of them in Matthew 23, Remember, this is the great Matthew chapter of the woes, right? All of the woes in Matthew 23. And Jesus says of them, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees." He said, "You hypocrites, because you travel around on sea and land and you make one proselyte." I mean, they did that. They would go all over the world looking for people and making them like them. "And when he becomes one, a proselyte, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves." Right? So their efforts were fruitless. Their efforts were fruitless. Instead of Gentiles coming to God and being sons of God, they become sons of the religious leaders. And Jesus says ultimately they are sons of hell. And twice that much. I mean, that's the idea. So the servant song goes on. But the servant song really takes a downturn. This is why we need to see broader contexts. Because yes, first part of this, we can apply all of that to Jesus. And yes, I believe that Jesus is the servant, that he is the embodiment of Israel. But in this narrative, the servant takes a downturn in verse 18. He says, "Hear, you deaf, and look, you blind, that you may see. Who is blind but my servant?" Now, obviously, that's not Jesus, but that's Israel, right? Israel is blind. They can't see. They can't see what God is trying to do in the world. They can't see what God is attempting through them. And he says, "Or so deaf as my messenger whom I send." Who is so blind as he? Now, they put a lowercase he on here, of course. "He that is at peace with me, or so blind as the servant of the Lord." To be at peace with God, to be a servant of God, right, should be the motivator to do God's will, shouldn't it? I mean, think about that for a minute. To be at peace with God, to be a servant of God, should be the motivator to do God's will, to live up to the reality of who you actually are as covenant people of God. But instead of hearing God and doing God's will, instead of seeing what he is doing in the world, what God is attempting, they remain deaf and they remain blind. And instead of being salt and instead of being light, they are tasteless and they are darkness. You see that? Do you see what's going on? Verse 20, he says, "You have seen many things," right? I mean, God has done so much through them and around them, and they've seen so many things, but you do not observe them. "Your ears are open, but they don't hear. And the Lord was pleased for his righteousness' sake to make the law great and glorious." Now, as 21st century Americans, we don't always think about law like this, right? We don't go around and sit around and think, man, our law is so great and glorious and wonderful. We love it and we read it all the time. But God's law is, isn't it? The laws of God's covenant are glorious. The laws of God's covenant are great, and they are to be loved and embraced and lived out. Verse 22, he says, "But this is a people plundered and despoiled. All of them are trapped in caves or are hidden away in prisons. They have become a prey with none to deliver them and a spoil with none to say, give them back." Right? And so someone has taken them away and there's just nobody there that cares enough to say, hey, I want them back. I want them to come back over here. You know, they've been taken as spoils of war and nobody is there to desire to have them back. Who will fight for these people? Who will fight for them? Who will care for them? Who will draw them back in? In verse 23, it said, "Who among you will give ear to this? Who will give heed and listen hereafter? Who gave Jacob? Who gave Jacob up for spoil and Israel to plunders? Was it not the Lord? Was it not the Lord against whom you have sinned and in whose ways they were not walking, willing to walk, and whose law they did not obey?" You see, their blindness, right? Their deafness will lead to their exile, right? And so exile to Babylon. Babylon will be their nation. They will be under the rule and reign of Babylon, but they will never truly cease to be under the rule and reign of God. See how that works? We find ourselves in a very similar circumstance today. But The fact is that their failure to embrace God's law, their failure to do the will of God, their failure to be a covenant to the people, to be a light to other nations, has led to their captivity by those very nations that they were supposed to influence. What good is salt when it loses its saltiness? Trample underfoot. What good is light when you hide it under a basket? It has no value. Their salt, their light, had no value. And the only one who can rescue them, God, right? He's the very one who has handed them over. Isn't that what's being said here? That the only one who can rescue them, the only one who can save them, the only one who really cares about them, he is the one who handed them over because of their disobedience, because of their lack of appreciation for what God has done for them. Now, it's true. It is true that God's people will eventually come out of captivity, right? Just read Ezra, read Nehemiah. It's true that their people will come out of Babylonian captivity, that God's going to deal with Babylon in that context. In fact, the whole Old Testament ends with this. That's really what it is. It's a sigh. It's this expectation that was never truly fulfilled. It's this concept and this idea and this hope that never really came to pass. And the whole Old Testament ends with tension. And you're just thinking, what's next? Right? I mean, if you only had the Old Testament, you got to the end of it, you would think, now what? Right? What are we waiting for? What's next? What's God going to do now? And then, Jesus comes, right? And then Jesus comes. And then he enters into the scene, and he comes in and preaches this great sermon on the mount and calls Israel back to himself, calling and raising up people to be his kingdom people, to be the salt, to be the light of the earth and the world. And Jesus, the son of Abraham, right? The son of David, the son of God. He comes into the world to be with God's people. And the whole Sermon on the Mount has two ways that you can look at it. One, it's a rebuke. And secondly, it's an invitation. It's a rebuke to the religious leaders in Jesus' day, isn't it? The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes, these leaders who were not leading God's servant to be a covenant to the nations, to be a light to the nations. They weren't doing that, but Jesus is, right? That's the rebuke. Jesus is. He actually fulfills this. He is Israel embodied, right? He is the servant of Isaiah 42. He is the one who comes in and actually does what God intended Israel to do, the embodiment of the hopeful expectation of what God's servant would be in these servant songs of Isaiah. Jesus is truly the one, isn't he? He's truly the one. He is the means through whom people, Gentiles, will come into a covenant relationship with the Lord. He is the one through whom they will come into a relationship with the Lord. And not just the covenant that God made with Israel, right? But a new covenant, a better covenant. One inaugurated on Jesus, blood of Jesus. That he is the mediator of a new and better covenant that he's inviting everybody into. Jew and Gentile and slave and free and male and female. We all join together and become part of this wonderful covenant that Jesus is the mediator of. He is the servant who truly is the light to the nations, isn't he? And the invitation is to follow him, right? To join with Jesus. That's the invitation, to join with him and to be salt. To be salt. To join with Jesus, to follow Jesus and to be light. To be light. To do the will of God by influencing the world around us, right? And inviting others to come and join in. That's the purpose of all this. So we can invite others to join us in following Jesus, the servant of God. And we're being shaped. We're, Whereas followers of Jesus, we're being shaped, we're being transformed into God's faithful servant in Christ Jesus, so that we become a servant. And Jesus has come to show us what that looks like, what that feels like, what we should expect of that, and how we are to live that out in our daily lives. So our question this morning, are we living up to this expectation? That's our question. Are you living up to this expectation? Are you being salt? Are you being light in the world around you? Those of us who've been baptized into Jesus, we are salt and we are light. Jesus is telling us to be what we already are. To be what we already are. Influence the world for good, right? To do the will of God. And then to invite others to join us in following Jesus and join us in this wonderful covenant of God, in a relationship with God through Jesus, to be salt and to be light. That's the invitation. So this morning, if you have not entered into that relationship with God, if you have not, through Jesus and through baptism, become part of that covenant family of God, then this is a good time to do that. If that's your desire, if that's your hope, if you want to join in as Jesus followers and participate in what God is doing in the world through his servants, then we do that through being baptized into Jesus and having our sins forgiven. Or if you need the prayers of the congregation and for encouragement and strength, please come forward as we stand and as we sing.